Well, the passage that we're looking at this evening is that final passage from the book of Mark, Mark chapter 16, verses 1 to 8. And this evening I just want to look at some of the major themes which arise from this final passage of Mark's gospel. But before we do that, we have to acknowledge something, and that's this, that this passage, of all the passages really in Mark's gospel, and perhaps even of all the passages in the New Testament, is problematic. And I suppose we could say that there are two problems here as we read this text, and two problems which we need to first briefly confront before we get into looking at the themes of this passage. And the first problem is, well, what do we do with Mark chapter 16, verses 9 to 20? We keep calling verses 1 to 8 our final passage, but most of our Bibles include those additional verses from verse 9 to verse 20. Now, here in our ESVs, you'll notice we have a little note telling us that some of the earliest manuscripts do not include verses 9 to 20. And I would suggest to you that even if we didn't have that note, many of us would agree, wouldn't we, that the verses which follow do feel strange. I didn't read them out to you, but I'm assuming that you've read them before in the past. And perhaps then, just in an indefinable way, there's just something very different about them. They don't really feel like Mark. They don't flow very naturally from verse 9. They contain some unexpected ideas. And when you do study them in the Greek, you find that the style and the words that are used here are markedly different to the other part of the gospel. They don't feel like Mark. And the fact is that the manuscript evidence strongly suggests that verses 9 to 20 are not authentic. They weren't written by Mark. Now, I don't want to get sidetracked by this, but just to briefly say that the two oldest and arguably most important manuscripts of the Bible don't include those verses. Several of the earliest Christian writers seem to have been completely unaware that these verses even existed. Men like Clement of Alexandria, men like Origen. And many of those very early manuscripts which do include these verses, well, they also include little markings or notes in the margin which indicate that the scribes who copied those verses also did not feel comfortable sort of seeing these verses as part of Mark's gospel. They didn't really view these verses as authentic. So, again, we're not going to get sidetracked by this issue, but I'm just saying at this stage my conclusion is that verses 9 to 20 are not written by Mark. What then are they doing here in this gospel? Well, probably they represent an attempt by the early church to give this gospel a more satisfying ending, which they felt was otherwise lacking. That is to say that early Christians felt like to end Mark's gospel at verse 8 of chapter 16 was a bit of a cliff edge. I mean, after all, in that passage which we read, we haven't yet met with the risen Lord Jesus. The disciples haven't reappeared in the narrative. There's no great commission taking place. All we have in verse 8 is the women's dumbstruck fear as they see the empty tomb. For many people, that would not have been a satisfying ending. And so in response to that, they tack on this other additional ending. So that's our first problem. But you see then, that then takes us to our second problem. And it's this. Well, did Mark intend to write... did Mark intend to end his gospel at verse 8 of chapter 16? And in response to that question, different people argue different things. Some people argue, yes, Mark intended to conclude his gospel in this very striking, very open-ended way, ending with the women's fear. Some argue, no, Mark intended to write more, but something happened. Perhaps Mark died. Perhaps Mark did write more, but it got lost somehow or something like that. Now, I'm not going to give you a comprehensive treatment of that question today. Suffice to say that both sides to that argument have strengths and weaknesses. And so all I'm going to say is this. Whether or not Mark intended to write more, or did write more, the simple and important fact remains that the Holy Spirit has not until now intended to give the church any more words from the pen of Mark. Now that might feel dissatisfying, because verse 8 might feel like a cliff edge. We might want more, and evidently the early church wanted more, but that is just tough. At the end of the day, this is what we have. Yes, this book ends abruptly. Yes, it lacks the conclusion we might have hoped for, but that is just the book which the Holy Spirit intended us to have. And so for that reason, this fear of the women is the end of our book. And some people say, well, we shouldn't make much of that because Mark intended to write more, but I don't think we can say that. This is the ending that the Spirit intended us to have, and that is not unimportant. That is something to be taken seriously. And we are going to take that seriously this evening. And in fact, my first heading this evening is going to be precisely on that theme, fear. Fear. That's my first heading, fear. So this is the point where our book ends. It ends on this note of unrelieved fear. And they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. I suppose the first thing to say here is that we don't hold it against these women for being afraid. A few years ago, unbeknownst to Hannah, my wife, I broke a milk jug. And Hannah liked that jug. It was a smart little jug, and it was quite sort of posh. It had the Welsh word for milk on the side of it. Hannah spent her university years in Wales. And so after breaking it, I decided as quick as a flash, I would try to find the exact model of that jug online and order it immediately. Well, I did find the model, and I did order it, and it was almost exactly the same in every way. The only trouble was that when the jug arrived, it was noticeably larger than the old one. And so one very ordinary day when we had guests round, Hannah went to make them some tea, and she went to the cupboard, not expecting to see anything strange. And unsurprisingly, in that moment, she was rather spooked by what she saw there, because her milk jug had grown. So we get it, don't we? Human beings are easily freaked out when they're confronted by things that they don't understand and they don't expect. These women go to that tomb not expecting to see anything strange. They bring their spices with them to anoint a body which, as far as they're concerned, is dead. They puzzle over who will move the stone, which, as far as they're concerned, is right where it was last. But instead they see the stone is rolled away. Instead they see this mysterious man who casually tells them that Jesus is not there, that he's vacated the area. Of course, these women are more than a little bit spooked. They're freaked out by what happens. And in a sense, so should we be as we read this passage. This book ends reminding us that what we're dealing with here really is, in a sense, spooky. That is to say, when you take this story seriously, and I mean really seriously, you realise that Christianity isn't quaint. It is fearful. It is a fearful thing. We read this passage, we get to verse 8, and then silence. And we're left there wondering, left with this overwhelming sense of supernatural awe. What has happened? Now, none of this is to say that what has happened here isn't extremely good. Of course it is, and we're coming to that. But before we see how good it is, we need to first see just how frighteningly big it is. Because Mark ends this book telling us things which are awesome. What is this passage about? It's about the single biggest anomaly to perforate the natural world since the days of creation itself. We have right here on record the moment when an empty tomb becomes the source of abundant, everlasting life. And that is mind-blowingly big and awesome and, yes, fearful. It is a frightening thing. Why are these women so afraid? Because they've just had a glimpse of the sheer power of God. The God which brought the universe into existence. The God who, in the language of Romans chapter 4, calls life out of death and calls into existence the things that do not exist. That is the power which is left sort of residing fearfully in the atmosphere as we close this book. Romans 4, which I mentioned just now, it tells us that Abraham had to trust that power of God, that sheer power of God, personally. His body was old, was as good as dead, Romans 4 tells us. Sarah's womb was barren. The idea of them having children seemed ridiculous. And yet it says, Abraham believed the God who gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist. That is what we're dealing with here in Mark chapter 16. We're dealing with the sheer power of God, which gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist. The same power that spoke the whole world into existence. The same power that would still the storm on Lake Galilee in Mark chapter 4 of this gospel. The same power which would raise Jairus' daughter back to life in Mark chapter 5. And now, at the most dramatic moment since the creation itself, I would argue, that same power calls out of that empty tomb the new creation itself. How had Sarah reacted when she was told that she would have a child? Well, she was overcome, wasn't she? She burst into nervous laughter, it says. How did the disciples react when the storm was stilled on Galilee? It says in Mark 4, they were filled with great fear. How had Jairus' family reacted when the little girl was raised? It says they were immediately overcome with amazement. And that is what we see here again. We see these little human beings, these women, innocently bringing their spices to this tomb, and now they are knocked back by the sheer power of God. And if it spooks the child when the empty hat produces a rabbit, how much more when the empty grave produces everlasting life? So it's no surprise. We do not blame these women in Mark 16 for fleeing the tomb, seized by trembling and astonishment. And it's a reminder to us, isn't it, that this moment really happened. This really, really happened. And if that disturbs us a little bit, if that spooks us, if we can feel something of these women's fear, then all the better. That is what should happen. I think it's easy in our own age to feel, to allow the sort of anti-supernaturalism around us, the skepticism, to seep into our thinking, to not feel the impact of the supernatural. Because as far as we're concerned, it's all sort of bundled up in these old stories, in the language of the Bible. Or perhaps we see it sort of dramatized on our television screens, and there's something about seeing it there on the television which kind of just makes it feel unreal and we feel detached from it. Perhaps you're not a Christian this evening. Perhaps you don't believe in anything bigger than the natural world in which you live. Perhaps the supernatural is unbelievable to you. Well, here's what I'm telling you. These are real people in this passage in Mark 16. There really was a morning when these people, these real women, walked to that tomb carrying those jars of ointment, talking quietly and sadly amongst themselves. And when they got to that tomb, they really did see that the stone was rolled away. They really saw that gaping entrance. They really saw a young man in a white robe. And just as you would expect, they were rather overcome by what they saw and heard. And so that's the note that Mark's gospel ends on. These real human beings, not works of fiction. No, these real human beings with little lives and little minds, but now being swept up into God's big, awesome plan, witnessing the world's greatest miracle and feeling rather intimidated and overwhelmed by it. So, fear. That's my first point this evening, fear. But then, having dealt with that, I want us to see now that fear is not the only note which is struck by this passage. More than that, I want us to see now that actually this passage is not just a source of fear, it also places limits on our fear. For all the resurrection might be a frightening and supernatural thing, that's not the full picture. And so I have now two additional themes, and I decided in the end that these two themes are too overlapping, really, for me to keep completely separate, so I'm going to group them together in one heading, and we'll sort of look at them both at the same time a little bit. And both of these themes, then, they place limits on our fear. And so my second and my last point this evening is this: familiarity and forgiveness. Familiarity and forgiveness. Now, whether that word familiarity quite captures everything I'm trying to say here, I don't know. But I'm just trying to capture initially here that the sense of almost normality, almost ordinariness, almost quietness and casualness, familiarity that we get as we read this passage. Because yes, these women are terrified by the sight of that empty tomb, because that empty tomb implies resurrection. And resurrection, as I said, is the greatest miracle the world has ever witnessed. And yet, in and of itself, the sight of that empty tomb isn't really terrifying, is it? And I suppose that sort of sense of ordinariness, it extends to many of the features of this account. Because unlike the other Gospels, unlike Matthew's Gospel, for instance, Mark doesn't tell us about an earthquake in this passage. Mark doesn't show us an angel from heaven, described by Matthew as like lightning, rolling away the stone and sitting on it. He doesn't tell us about the Roman guards becoming like dead men. In Luke's Gospel, we have two men in dazzling apparel, the sight of which sort of bows those women to the ground. In Mark, we only have this one young man. Now, I'm not saying that the other Gospels are inconsistent or wrong or anything like that, but I'm saying, look at what Mark is emphasizing here. It's very ordinary. It's not angels, or at least the language we're given is not that of angels. It's a young man. And yes, presumably this young man is an angel. His young body disguises a vast supernatural creature, and something of that terrifies these women. But the way Mark portrays him, he's not exactly a scary sight, is he? Not really. He's not like the terrifying cherubim of the book of Ezekiel with their wings and their many heads. He's a young man, and he's just sitting there. And he almost speaks casually with these women, very matter of fact. Verse 6, and he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he's going before you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." It's almost as if he sort of looks up from his newspaper and says, "You're looking for Jesus, aren't you? Well, he's not in there, I'm afraid. You've just missed him, actually. Don't worry, though. If you head back to Galilee, you'll meet him there, just like he said." Now, maybe I'm exaggerating that a little bit. He does have an air of authority about him. But even still, given that what's just happened in this passage is the sheer power of God, the scale of which has never been seen before since the days of creation, this man does present that news very casually, doesn't he? So what do we learn from that? What do we learn from the casual, familiar attitude of this man? Well, here's one thing initially I think that we learn. I think one impression we get from this casualness, familiarity, is that actually what has happened here at the empty tomb is not that surprising. It's not that surprising. In other words, the man is reporting the facts as if these women sort of should have expected it. In fact, he ends with those words, doesn't he? "There you will see him in Galilee, just as he told you." Just as he told you. Jesus had told the disciples that he would rise and go to Galilee. Chapter 14, verse 28, After I am raised up, Jesus said, I will go before you to Galilee. He told them, he made it plain enough for them. And in chapter 14, when he'd said that, the disciples were very eager to object to Jesus' death full stop and didn't really register this comment about going to Galilee. But he had told his followers again and again and again that he would rise and, as he tells them in Mark 14, that he would go to Galilee. So the point is this, that for all this is the biggest miracle creation has ever seen, it is equally true to say that for those who knew Jesus, nothing surprising should have taken place on that third day. Again and again, Jesus had told his followers what to expect. Why then should they be at all surprised when it happens, in the words of the angel, just as he told them? Perhaps I could ask you this question this evening. Are you expecting resurrection? I'm not talking about Christ's resurrection now. I'm talking about your resurrection. After all, in Mark's gospel, Jesus speaks just as confidently of the day of your resurrection than he does of his own resurrection. And that day of resurrection, yes, it will be astonishing. Yes, it will be mind-blowing. It will be overwhelming. We might say it will be a fearful day in many respects. But at the very least, it won't be, or it shouldn't be, unexpected. It needn't be surprising. When that day arrives, we needn't receive it with disbelief. Jesus told us it would happen. The Bible tells us on countless occasions that it would happen. And I just want to remind you of this. As certainly as next Tuesday is coming, Resurrection Day is coming. Indeed, Resurrection Day is more certain than next Tuesday. And the more we can believe it, the more familiar we can become with this reality, the more we should find ourselves changed by that belief. I'm not saying it will drive away all of our sorrows. It won't turn us into sort of happy-go-lucky, bubbly people. But it should give us a greater sense of peace. It should make us more joyful. It should be a real source of confidence in times of trouble. Resurrection Day will come. Jesus has said it will come. That is all we need. We need nothing more. Case closed. It is coming. Allow that fact to change you. Believe it. Believe it. Believe it. Believe it. Now, I want to come back to this theme of familiarity. But in order to do that, I just want to consider now another group of people who are mentioned in this passage, namely the disciples. See, a few weeks ago when we looked at the previous passage of Mark's Gospel, we mentioned the fact that this book, the final portion of this book, focuses not upon the disciples, it focuses upon the actions of the women. The last we saw of the disciples was back in chapter 14. You remember what happens in 14? The mob comes along to arrest Jesus, and these disciples, they've been so confident that they would defend Jesus to the death. And what happens? Chapter 14, verse 50, and they all fled. They all left him and fled. They're the final words we get with regards to the disciples' actions. It's a sorry sight. It's a failure. Peter, in particular, is a failure that night. He denies his Lord three times and with an oath. And again, we've seen no more of him since the last verse of chapter 14. It just says, and he broke down and wept. That's it. That's all we're getting of Peter as far as this gospel is concerned. We're told nothing more about what happens to him afterwards. So, as active characters, those men, those disciples, they do not return to this narrative. That's true. And that's what we considered last time. But what I want us to see here is that at the same time as that, the very last verses of this book are actually all about those men. Verse 7, the penultimate verse here, the young man, the angel, says to the women, but go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. So my point is that for all we see no more of those disciples in Mark's gospel, and there's a point to be made about that, Mark ends this book telling us that Jesus will be seeing those men again. Indeed, Jesus wants to see those men again. Indeed, Jesus so wants to see those men again that this angel passes that on to these women. A reunion is going to take place between Jesus and his disciples. And as Malcolm mentioned in his prayer on Wednesday night, the angel doesn't just refer to a reunion with the disciples in general. He specifically mentions, of all of these men, Peter. That failure upon failures. The one who really mucked it up big time. The one who denied and denied and then denied with an oath. He mentions him. He wants to see him again. And so I'm sure you can see my other theme now coming through here. Forgiveness. Forgiveness. Had chapter 14 really been the last mention of the disciples in this book, then we might have concluded that it was all over for them now, that their failure really was the final word, it was game over for the disciples. But no, much to our great relief, they are not eliminated from the story. They are not left hanging. We're not left wondering what the future holds for them, because their past failure has not undone Jesus' love for them. And that includes, in particular, Peter. Jesus wants to see you again, Peter. Indeed, this angel doesn't even mention any past failure, does he? He doesn't so much as gesture towards past failure. It's as if it's never happened, because that's what the forgiveness of Jesus is like towards his closest friends and towards us this evening. This is the forgiveness of Jesus Christ, who pardons us. Before I close, I want to return to that theme of familiarity. And I said that these two themes, familiarity and forgiveness, they're difficult to keep separate. And I say that because in some ways, this theme of familiarity actually serves to reinforce the forgiveness. Now, what do I mean by that? Why do I say that? Well, just let me sort of conclude here with a couple of things. I want to observe a couple of things in this passage. Notice first where this reunion between Jesus and his disciples is going to take place. It's going to take place, verse 7, in Galilee. Jesus is going before them to Galilee. In other words, this reunion is going to take place on familiar territory. It's going to take place on home turf. There's no reason why Jesus couldn't have just met with his disciples in Jerusalem. But no, he chooses to spend most of his time with them in a place which is familiar and homely both to them and to him. Galilee, that's home for the disciples. After all the drama of Jerusalem, just how good it must have felt to get back home to Galilee, to get back to Galilee with its rippling shorelines and the smell of the fish markets and the sound of the gulls in the air and all those familiar sights and places where they spent time together. There's something so satisfying about this ending, isn't there? It's just a return to normality. And I think, as I'm saying, it underscores the fact that fundamentally the relationship between Jesus and his friends has not been altered by anything which has taken place. Forgiveness reinforced by this familiarity. And then secondly, notice the kind of Jesus that they're going to meet there in Galilee. What does this man say to them? Verse 6, he says to the women, "You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified." Now, think about this for a moment. The man these disciples are going to meet in Galilee is the resurrected Son of God. He has just won a heavenly battle. He has just crushed Satan's head into the ground. He wields unfathomable power and authority. He has a new relationship with time and space itself now. He has transcended death forever. He is the first fruit of a new creation which we can scarcely begin to imagine. And how is that man, referred to here? Well, he's referred to still as Jesus of Nazareth. In fact, the final reference to Jesus in this book is very much like the way in which Jesus enters the narrative at the beginning of the book in chapter 1. Chapter 1, verse 9, Jesus enters the narrative with these words, "In those days, Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee." So in other words, the man that we're meeting here is the same man that we have known all the way through this gospel. For all the change which has taken place in him because of resurrection, there remains something local about Jesus. He remains Jesus of Nazareth. We end on this note of familiarity, of continuity with everything that we've been seeing. And I just want you to imagine for a second how reassuring that must have been for these disciples. They're not meeting now some unknown entity on some distant alien planet out there. No, they're meeting their friend. They're meeting a man whom they have gotten to know. And they're looking forward to reunion with him. And it reinforces once again that sense of happy restoration. Everything is back to normal now. That's the point. We spoke about fear in our first point, but we need to remember that the first words the angel speaks in verse 6 are, "Do not be alarmed." Jesus has counseled people against fear. Many occasions, or several occasions in this gospel. He did it for the disciples on Lake Galilee. He did it for Jairus' family when the girl was raised. So yes, Jesus is the holy God. And yes, he is a God to be feared. But for the Christian, guilty fear is not to be our defining reaction to the risen Lord Jesus Christ. Perhaps we as Christians can have the same misgivings that these disciples may have had. You know, when I meet with Jesus, is my guilt still clinging to me? Is the air between us still somehow bad? Is it still got this guilt in it? My frequent foolishness, time and time again in this life, is that going to be lurking somewhere in the atmosphere as I meet with Jesus? Well, for the Christian, the answer to all those questions is emphatically no. No, it's not. Meeting with the resurrected Jesus is not an occasion we should worry about. If he has forgiven us, then he has forgiven us completely. Happy restoration. And yes, as we look forward to eternity, we are looking into a world which is big. And for us little human beings, scary. When we look towards our futures beyond the grave, we're looking into a place which is unknown, which the Bible doesn't tell us much about. We don't know what paradise will be like. We don't know what the new creation will be like. In many ways, it exceeds the outer limits of our imagination. We're trying to imagine things which we just cannot be conceived of here. And that does intimidate us a little bit. But I think, at the very least, the end of Mark's gospel tells us this. It tells us that however weird and unimaginable and spooky eternity might seem to us right now, however much it might exceed our imaginations, however otherworldly we might think it will be, nevertheless, it will remain a return to a happy normality. It will be a homecoming. It will be a place which, in a sense, will be fundamentally familiar to us. And so, I am ending now. Think of what this moment is like for these disciples as they follow Jesus' instruction and they see him in Galilee. Seeing that Jesus might well have felt very strange at first. It might have felt overwhelming for them. But that didn't prevent it from being simply a happy reunion with a good friend. A friend who has remained in the most fundamental way extremely familiar to them. The idea that he was back again was something fundamentally happy for these men. And I want that to be the same for us. When that day comes, when eternity arrives, when we are raised up from the graves, we won't be terrified. We will feel like we are home. And in the presence of Jesus Christ, we will feel like we are with family. And that is a great and wonderful thing that we can all look forward to. And so I encourage you this evening, think of it in this way. You are going home. You are meeting your older brother. Look forward to it. Let that be a great peace to all of you. Amen.